the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Wade Fow. We'll talk about the 4% solution, actually rethinking it as part of the new math and the way people are viewing retirement today. You know, here on this particular program, we tackle a number of issues. The overall theme is how to prepare for retirement, how to live longer, how to stay healthy, and not to outlive your assets. That's very important. And I have to admit, you know, when you look at all of this, this can be a daunting task. It's not easy. The fact that people are living longer is considered a benefit, but it also poses some issues. I mean, there are major technology advances in medicine. We've had a number of guests here who have talked to us about the role of diet and remaining active and reducing stress. Lifestyle has a very important effect on your health, even a role in both dementia and Alzheimer's, and there are things you can do to actually control this. The financial part is a bit harder. It's never been in an environment like today with 0% interest rates. The central bank intervention is making it more difficult to navigate, and the rules seem to be changing every single time you turn around. So hopefully we can show you how to overcome these issues.
You know, it's interesting because when Social Security was put into effect in 1933, John, the life expectancy of a male was somewhere probably in the age of 63 to 65. Now, you take a look at Social Security has new actuarial tables. So if you are a male born today, your life expectancy is now 76.1 years. So life expectancy is increased by a little over 11 years for male. If you are a female being born today, your life expectancy is roughly about 81 years. Now, those numbers change the older you get. For example, a male at age 65 has a life expectancy of almost 18 years. So it moves up to almost 83 years for a male. For a female, her life expectancy is over 20 years. It moves up to over 85, a little over 85 years. So the numbers on life expectancy increase the older you get. In fact, the average couple today entering into retirement, let's say an average age of 65, could expect somewhere between 20 and 25 years of their life will be spent in lifetime. And as Dr. Wade Fow, in a recent article he wrote, interviewed in Barron's, he said there's a 50% chance that one of you could live to be age 95. I just attended a conference where I saw a gentleman talking about the technology and what is happening to medicine today that they're working on, John, having people live beyond 100. So that creates all kinds of problems, and that's what we're going to be talking about in today's show.
So the answer to that is to drop dead at age 40.
Well, that solves the retirement issue. You never get to retirement.
Listen, I'm sure that's something the government would like right now, Jim, because that way they wouldn't have to pay out all these Social Security benefits, because we know sooner or later they're going to have to reform that. It just can't keep going the way it has. Well, you know, we've had a number of doctors and researchers on the program that stress the concept of proper diet and nutrition. And speaking of stress, reducing stress, people are actually working longer. I remember Viktor Frankl, the psychiatrist, came out with a book right after his experiences in Auschwitz, if you can believe that, called Man's Search for Meaning. And he found that people who had a purpose in life tended to live much longer and stay alive even during difficult circumstances. He said as soon as they lost that, you know, then basically they died very rapidly. So people are working longer. They're challenging their brains longer. This can go a long way to staying healthy, to preventing dementia, to preventing Alzheimer's. Weight control is really important. It plays a very important role in hypertension and in diabetes and in heart disease. So this is a big factor. A lot of people, Jim, just don't know how to do that. Now, I lost about 16 pounds last summer and gained a little back during the winter, but going back on the same diet should be able to drop even more. And sure enough, you can see your cholesterol numbers and your blood pressure come down with that. It's a major factor. I even challenged my doctor recently when I went, and we have a terrific doctor. And the first time I saw him, he says, "Well, you know, Mr. Loeffler, your body mass index is a little high." I said, "Okay, doc, okay, doc, I got this challenge for you. I said, I'll go on any diet you put me on. I've been on all sorts of diets over my career. There's just one thing. You have to guarantee me that it's going to work. And he got real quiet. And I said, so shut up and don't ever talk to me about it again. Of course, I was joking with him. Okay. And he laughed at it. I said, you know, you guys are really good at telling me I need to lose weight, but you're lousy at telling me how to do it in anything that works. And there are thousands of other people out there, Jim, that go through the same experience. You know the old experience. You go on a diet, you lose 5 or 10 pounds. And at that point, I'm so sick of eating seaweed, I can't stand it, or something like that. And their weight zooms right back up.
You know the ones I like where you have to measure your food? I mean, it's just a lot of this stuff is really so impractical. And like you, John, I've tried being a vegetarian. I've tried the Mediterranean diet. And the thing that I found, and I'm a little biased here, that worked best for me was the paleo diet. You know, I lost over 20 pounds and I've been able to keep that weight off. I think I have a goal of about another 5 or 6. But even then, with just the research that I have found out, I'm moving more towards Dr. Amy Meyer's autoimmune diet, which is really keeping the body pH balanced, which really creates an environment that cancer can't survive. It's also good for heart disease, diabetes. And we had Dr. Amy Myers here on her book, The Autoimmune Solution, what was it, just a couple months ago. And also, one of the things that I found very helpful is Dr. Gary Small, who heads up the Longevity Center at UCLA. His advice in terms of dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's, in fact, I just finished his new book called 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain and highly recommend it. I use things like brain games such as Lumosity and also thinking of taking up the game of bridge. I know my wife's mother and grandmother were bridge masters. Her grandmother lived well into their 90s. You hear people like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett that are avid bridge players. But it's not just diet. It's also the right blend of everything from exercise, from cardio to weightlifting, because we know that your muscles tend to atrophy the older you get, maintaining flexibility, and even yoga for flexibility, also hypertension. So it's amazing the things that you can do today and the advances that we're making in medical science. As I mentioned, I just attended a conference where they were talking about people living into their hundreds.
Well, you know, I started last year, and Carol and I did, on the alkaline diet, which is similar to what you're talking about, pH control. Lost 16 pounds, went in for my physical last year, and the very same doctor that I told to shut up before looked at me and said, what did you do? That was his first question. And I said, it's called an alkaline diet. You need to tell your patients about it, you know. Well, you've studied health, as have I. I took it seriously in my 30s. It's where I got a road bike, which I've almost got 50,000 miles on it right now. And any recommendations, books to read for listeners?
You know, a couple things, and we've interviewed most of the books I'm going to recommend. You know, I'm somewhat biased based on what has worked for me. And there's a book called The Paleo Diet by Lauren Cordain. And then there's also one called The Paleo Solution by Rob Wolf and Lauren Cordain. We interviewed Rob Wolf here on the program, I think, last year. The other one that we interviewed recently that this gets more, John, towards your pH balanced diet, it's where I'm moving towards. It's called The Autoimmune Solution by Dr. Amy Myers. It's amazing the amount of cures of autoimmune diseases and all kinds of disorders that this kind of diet, you know, we're finding more and more that diet plays such a role. About 70 to 80% of most disease originates in the gut. So you have a healthy gut, you're less likely to get a serious illness. So highly, highly recommend that book. For brain health, there's Dr. Gary Small's book. He's written a number of them. I just finished, as I mentioned, his newest book called 2 Weeks to a Younger Brain. And I also recommend an earlier book that he wrote, especially if you have issues like dementia or maybe a history of Alzheimer's in your family. He wrote a book called The Alzheimer's Prevention Program. You know, between those books can give you a good jump start on keeping healthy, because diet, we're finding more and more, plays such a key role in terms of our health.
We want to point out for listeners that they can listen to interviews with the authors of all of those books that Jim just talked about. They've been interviewed here on the program, as well as other health experts. The point making here is that advances in medicine are making us able to live longer and to live healthier as we do it. I mean, I'm thinking of my father-in-law right now, who's 95 and is still going rather strong. Proper diet Exercise is good. I would recommend you be cautious about your exercise. 2 years ago on the 4th of July, I got out to ride my bike and turned a corner and came face to face with a moose. And we both discovered each other at the very same moment. We both jumped. And I thought, oh my gosh, do we have a situation where she's going to charge? Well, she left me alone and I left her alone. And otherwise, a moose could be dangerous to your health. But other than that, getting out on the bicycle or running or whatever works for you, swimming is really good, is really important to a long life. There is no reason why you can't live a long and healthy life. I mean, some people have certain genetic propensities. Knowing your genetic propensities based on family background also gives you a chance to avoid disease ahead of time, which presents the next problem. Let's assume that you succeed in living a long time. Well, now you're running the risk of outliving your assets, because if you're living a long time, you still have to survive. And that's a topic that you and Dr. Wade Fowler are going to discuss today.
The problem too, John, and this is related to health, you know, people are living longer. The life expectancy has grown by almost 11 years since Social Security was launched. But there's problems that come up as a result of this. One, we're living longer. What that means is you have to have your assets take care of you over a longer period of time. Number two is dealing with inflation. And number three is something that is new as a result of the financial crisis, both the bursting of the tech bubble and then also the financial crisis in 2007 to 2009, is we're living in a new investment environment. Basically, as many have said here on the program, especially our weekend program, we're in uncharted territory today when it comes to interest rates. We're at 3 to 5 century lows. And unlike 2009, stocks are no longer as cheap as they once were. So all these conventional rules about investments no longer apply. And this is the trouble, because most financial planning models are based on an investment world that no longer exists. I mean, if we take a look at interest rates from 2000 to 2005, and also where they were in 1981 to 2015, in 2005, we had 10-year treasuries at 6.5%. Today, we're closer to 2.2%. So we've seen a dramatic drop in interest rates, which used to be, you know, let's say fixed income, whether it was bank CDs or bonds, were pretty much a large staple in anyone's retirement portfolio. To me, in my estimation, there's more risk in the bond market today. And we saw that recently with the backup of German bund yields, where they went from 7 basis points to 72 basis points, and they did that in just a 2-week period of time. And here's the problem for many retirees and all these models that we relied on for decades, is bonds were supposed to provide safety and predictability, and which they did if you owned them, and especially if you bought individual bonds. But that's not what most people did. They bought bond funds, and think of what's happened if you bought a bond fund in 2000. You've seen your income drop and the dividends drop just about every single year. So most retirees own bond funds, which have no maturity and no predictability, which creates even more uncertainty when it regards to, let's say, outliving your assets.
I want to bring up something that is somewhat related to longevity, and it also relates to investing, by the way, and that is inflation. I mean, we knew even before we went into the Affordable Health Care Act and before we had the financial crisis of 2007-08 that medical costs alone were actually outstripping inflation. But inflation itself, as far as your daily costs and costs of living, they're also a factor here.
Yeah, there was a recent study that was done on the inflation rate experienced by seniors, and it is higher, John, than the overall economy. In fact, the Labor Department showed they came up with a special inflation index trying to measure the cost that most seniors experience, and the regular CPI was running about 5.1% lower between the years 1985 to 2014 than one, let's say, affecting senior Americans. In fact, the culprit here is something we talk often about this show, and that's why we talk about health issues, is healthcare, which accounts for almost 13% of expenditures. You compare that to about 5% to all other age groups. In fact, here's some statistics. A 65-year-old couple today can plan on spending between $240,000 and $326,000 on medical costs, that's medical and drugs, over their retirement years. And that does not include long-term care, which makes it really difficult, because those expenses, John, usually occur in the later years and they can be horrific when they occur and really catch somebody off guard if not prepared for with, let's say, proper planning or some contingency planning built into your retirement plan. Most retirement plans ignore this. They're saying, okay, this is what your budget is. This is what your income is. And if it matches, gee, you're great and you're going to be fine. A lot of them just don't take into account these factors such as inflation and rising medical costs, which occur in the latter part of your retirement life.
Let me frame this whole thing. If you look at these issues, people are living longer. There's greater inflation, lower interest rates. That means lower refunds. And of course, lower returns as a result of that. And what you really have to come to grips with, this isn't a panic moment. It's just come to grips with the new rules. New rules apply here. You know, I read somewhere that healthcare expenses will consume, this is anticipated now, 67% of Social Security income for anyone retiring this year. And that figure, given where inflation's going, recalling that Social Security is not keeping up with that, could rise to 83% by the time that individual person reaches 85 years old. So how do you properly plan for these issues? Or Jim, is panic a better idea because it's just not possible?
We suggest panic. No, I mean,
is there organized panic or just unplanned panic?
Organized panic. It works better.
Okay.
You're touching upon some real key things here because the gap between, let's say, the cost of living on Social Security and healthcare inflation has widened tremendously. But most of these issues, John, could be addressed with proper planning that is well thought out and not these sort of what I call cookie cutter approaches based on models that really no longer apply to today's investment environment.
All right, well, let's tackle this issue. First of all, what should retirees or potential retirees do to make sure that they don't die broke or run out of money, for that matter?
The first thing, and gosh, folks, you're probably not going to like this, but it is so critical. Companies can't run without a budget. Households can't run without a budget. Retirees can't run without a budget as well. And we always like to break down that budget because this is really key to long-term retirement planning and especially getting to a point where you don't run the risk of running out of money. And that is, we break the budget down into basic needs. What does it cost you to live on a day-to-day basis? And then we have sort of what we call the bucket list or the wish list. And what you really want to do, rather than look at some generalized model and say, hey, I can withdraw 4% a year, 3%, or whatever these models tell you, you want to look at sources of income that cover your basic budget with money that doesn't run out. Now, what are some examples of money that doesn't run out? Social Security is not going to run out. The government's going to give you that check for as long as you live. If you have a pension from the government, teacher's pension, or a company pension, they pay that to you as long as you live, as well as something called immediate annuities, which Dr. Pfau and I will be talking about in the interview because he's done a lot of studies on these rules and also various forms of withdrawal and retirement. The important point, this way, you don't worry about running out of money when it comes to your lifespan. That way, your basic needs are covered by things that are assured, like Social Security, a pension, or an annuity. And what that does, it frees up you to deal with, let's say, the other expenses, the wish list and inflation, with your portfolio to handle inflation and the bucket list and also medical expenses. John, when you take a look at this, it is basic budgeting and cash flow planning, something that every corporation does on an annual basis. You look at financial statements that corporations issue, there's an income statement, a balance sheet, and a cash flow statement. It's the same set of methodology that should apply to retirement plan. Taking a look at your sources of income, your budget, your cash flow, and the assets you have to work with.
Okay, well, what makes this plan work? I mean, I know you spend a lot of time on budgets, but does it really get down to the issue of a budget? Is that the core issue here?
In many ways, it really does, because you need some sort of secure income that your normal expenses are going to be covered the rest of your life. As I talked about, whether it's Social Security, pensions, or an annuity. In fact, annuities, as Dr. Pfau will talk, have proven to be more effective than bonds due to you can't outlast an annuity. If an insurance company says that, you know, we're going to pay you X amount of dollars for as long as you live or your wife lives, that insurance company is on the hook for the longevity risk. And once you are assured that your basic needs have been met, Then you can start focusing on the bucket list, inflation, and healthcare. And believe it or not, Professor Pfau showed studies show that stock allocation should increase as you get older. And that is when you're going to get hit with medical cost. And think about it, your expenses today compared to what they'll be 15 years from now when inflation over time erodes that budget. But when we do this, we run analysis on budgets and especially on inflation, and we look at the possible income streams to match these expenses, and then we stress test these budgets and assumptions to make sure that you don't run the risk that in year 10, 15, you start pinching pennies and you start running out of money.
You know, and I'm wondering what's going to happen if the Federal Reserve ever comes upon its own day of reckoning where it can't help but introduce more and more inflation. We're already seeing that even though we're told inflation's low, because everything that has to do with basic expenses is inflating, from food, housing, and medical expenses to utilities, insurance, both for your home and car insurance. And even travel is going to become more expensive. And of course, that's affected by what's going on geopolitically and the price of oil. This whole drop in the price of oil was sort of an aberration, an interlude between different increases. But certainly no one 15 years ago actually saw what we're experiencing today, especially given the lowest interest rates in centuries. And that shows how, to a certain degree, Jim, the future is unpredictable, but a plan helps you cope with that.
You talk about what we spend so much time talking about on this program, which is retirement planning. You're right, John. It's become more complex today. You have the issue of people living longer, as we talked about, which triggers the problem of healthcare inflation. You live longer, you're probably more likely to run into medical issues as a result of living longer. Then you look at the investment returns today. We have probably the lowest interest rates that we have seen in centuries. I mean, in 2000, as I mentioned earlier, I could have got 5% on a two-year treasury. Today, a two-year treasury pays little over 0.5%. Bonds, back in 2000, I had no problem getting 6 to 8%. You're lucky if you can get 3.5% today. Let me give you an example. TLT, which is an ETF that buys 20-year treasuries, the dividend yield on that is 2.6%. If you go to LQD, which is corporate bonds, the yield on that is a little over 3.3%. So income yields aren't where they are to support a normal retirement. And this is forcing several issues. We're seeing people retire later. We're seeing people postpone Social Security to get a higher benefit. Or, John, something else we're seeing is people are working part-time.
All right, what about stocks? I mean, we've talked about stocks having a yield much better in many cases than you're going to find on bonds. But here's the deal, and this has been no lack of conversation on our shows here. After two bear markets, you find retirees in bond funds where they're exposed, and there may be storms coming on these in the very near future, not to mention low yield. And now Professor Pfau seems to be offering a recommendation of increasing stocks as couples retire and get older. Now, this is counterintuitive to some of the word on the street and what people experienced in times past. Explain the reasoning behind this concept.
Well, the key is, I mean, let's suppose that you put, I don't know, 50, 60% of your portfolio in stocks when you retire. And we'll see this in a case study that we're going to talk about today. And then all of a sudden, let's say you retire January 1st of 2008, and you go through a bear market. Well, if you're going through a bear market where stocks lose 40, 50% of their value or even more, as we saw in the bursting of the tech bubble, and you're drawing down your assets, what is happening is you are spending principal that you need that doesn't get the chance to benefit when the market turns around. And we saw this happen in 2009, John, where a lot of money got out of the stock market and went into bond funds. And they missed out on this almost 200% return that we've seen in stocks when the S&P got down to 666 on today, we're over 2100. And so it's something where if you're less subject to, let's say, a downturn in the market by the way you structure your assets when you first retire, then later on in life, you can start gradually increasing the percentage of stocks because you haven't gone through, let's say, a major downturn at the beginning of your retirement, which is what happened to a couple we're going to talk about in today's case study.
At the beginning of that program here today, I talked about the 4% rule, which has been used by advisors traditionally. What does this rule do? What's the proper use of this rule? Or if we're in this changing environment, which we're discussing, does it even work today?
Well, I mean, the 4% rule recommends starting out with an allocation of usually 50 to 60% stocks, the rest in bonds. But John, this rule was formulated in the 1990s when it was possible to get 7 and 8% on a bond. The returns in the bond market today are a fraction of that. So problems with this rule, it's not working out longer term. And Professor Pfau says a safer number is 3% is probably a better rule. Because hypothetically, let's just simplify this. Let's say that you have a life expectancy of 25 years between you and your spouse in retirement. If you withdraw 4% of your assets each year, that would last you 25 years. Now, you have to account for inflation and other factors, but that was basically the gist of it. And we know today that the returns, whether you're looking at stocks or you're even looking at bonds, that there's just no way that we're getting those kind of returns. I mean, we saw interest rates, as I mentioned, two-year treasuries. You know, I could have got over 5% in 2000. Today, I'm lucky to get over 0.5%. 10-year treasuries were at 6.5. Today, they're at 2.2. So you can see what's happened to a major staple of retirement plan portfolios, which was the bond market. Now we're looking at 0% negative interest rates. It's a totally different market today.
Right. So given the fact that it is a different market, how do you handle this particular issue? Because obviously, you probably work with some kind of a benchmark, Jim, when you're doing retirement planning.
We don't go by 4% rules, 3% rules. What we do is we do what corporations do. We focus on a budget and we break that budget just as a company does. The company may have an operating budget and a capital expenditure budget. We do the same. We start out with a basic budget and then we try to use a combination of strategies targeting the basic budget, making sure that basic expenses are covered for life with things like pensions, Social Security, and annuities. And by targeting basic expenses, we recommend things like file and suspend strategies to maximize Social Security benefits, annuities to create the same impact or effect of having, let's say, a defined benefit pension plan, especially for individuals in the private sector, and then dividend-paying stocks to provide for the wish list, handle things like medical expenses and inflation. And we found this strategy, John, is much more effective in handling retirement needs rather than some kind of, you know, broad-based pie chart percentage rule. The problem with percentage rules is there's less certainty today. In the example, as I talked about, the last 15 years, treasuries have gone from 6.5 to 2.2. And, you know, here's one. Just a couple months ago, 10-year treasuries got down to 1.6%. So the problem is there's so much risk using these models because they don't work anymore. And that's why we tend to target budgets and approach it just like a business does. And we've used a combination of strategies. And we found out, John, it works a lot better with a lot more predictable outcome.
So if we pull all this together so people understand the whole concept, the strategy as a solid unit here, we're living longer thanks to medical advances and people are paying attention to their diet, to their healthcare, nutrition, exercise, and they're living healthier lives. Now, seniors are subjected to higher inflation rates. If you live longer, in the environment in which we are, inflation is going to continue going up and investment returns are at an all-time low, are less predictable, as a matter of fact. You're not quite sure where you're going to wind up at any given point. So what this means is a greater risk of outliving your assets. But if it is done right, proper planning can resolve these issues. So we don't want a cookie cutter plan based on some ideas that are no longer valid. Remember, people have models. Models work as long as the environment in which they were created still exists. If the environment no longer exists, remember, when the horse is dead, remember to dismount. Don't try to ride the dead horse. Change and get a horse that works. So you have to have a model that actually works in the middle of all of this. No cookie cutter approaches. Everybody is different, but you have to do what works in this environment. And now let's see if we can put this concept into practice, Jim, which we always do here on the program. We take a case study where the names have been changed to protect the people and their privacy, but this is a real world case study.
This is a case study that we've talked here on the program previously, but I want to bring it up today because it illustrates so many of the points that we've been talking about in today's program. This is the case of Bill and Jan Smith. Bill was age 66 when he retired. Jan is age 58. She would retire in 2 years. Currently, her salary is roughly $80,000 as a grade school teacher. Now, Bill's background, a little bit about him. He was an executive, worked for a high-tech company. He got a early retirement package back in 2006. He had a couple choices. He could have got $6,000 on a pension monthly for the rest of his life. Of course, that was based on his life only, not his wife's. And so what he did is chose to take his money in a lump sum because they figured, you know, not only would they have greater control of it, but also to leave some money not only for his spouse, Jan, but also for their kids. So he chose to roll over the money in a lump sum. Jan, on the other hand, was a grade school teacher. She had about 2 years left prior to retirement. And basically, the way the school system works on the retirement here, you got 2.2% for every year of work. In two more years, she would have 30 years. So she would get 66% of her $80,000 salary when she retired. So basically, that'll give you a little backgrounder here in terms of where we're going with this plan.
Let's take a primary look here at their income versus expenses.
And when we take a look at income, Bill's Social Security was roughly about $1,450 a month. That was about $17,400. When Jan goes to retire 2 years, she would get 66% of that $80,000 salary. That'd be roughly about $54,000. So they had what I called a secure source of income of roughly about almost $72,000. They had roughly about $28,000 coming in from their investment portfolio, which I'll get to in just a moment. So their income was a little over $99,000 a year. The problem was their budget was $110,000 a year. If we subtract their $71,000 or almost $72,000, it left a $38,000 shortfall. And then if we add their investment income, they were short by close to $11,000. Now, the reason they were short, a couple of reasons. Bill, as I mentioned, he had a choice to get $6,000 a month based on his life only, but that didn't make sense because number one, he had heart disease. Number two, his wife was 8 years younger, longevity running in their family. So they, you know, Bill chose when he retired. Now remember when he did, 2006, he rolled it over into an IRA, lump sum, and then along came the financial crisis and that $800,000 IRA dropped down to about $650,000. So most of that was kept in bank CDs after the crisis. Unfortunately, he got out of the market. Now, looking at their budget, they had $90,000. That was the essential budget. $15,000 on the bucket list, and that mainly was travel. An additional $5,000 they were gifting to their grandkids, totaling about $110,000.
Now, what about medical care? Because this is always a biggie, as you say.
Well, you know, Bill was on Medicare, being age 66. Jan was covered under private insurance at age 65. When she retires, she'll go on Medicare. They had a Medicare supplemental policy, roughly about $2,600 for Bill. It'd probably be a little bit less for Jan. And something that they did that was pretty smart, and this was based on a history of heart disease in Bill's family, he got long-term care insurance. So the long-term care and Medicare with the supplement took care of the medical. So medical really wasn't going to be an issue here.
Okay, let's get into the weeds here. You had to wade into this. How did you solve the issue?
Okay, let's start with something we've been talking about today. The essential budget was $90,000. Secure income against that was roughly about $72,000. That would be Jan's pension and Bill's Social Security. We had roughly about $15,000 in bucket list expenses added to that $90,000. So the medical expenses were pretty much taken care of. The problems were inflation and also dealing with the surviving spouse and the fact that we had an income shortfall. Well, they didn't have a plan, which is why they came to us. So we wanted to make sure we had essential income, and then also we wanted to take care of longevity. So what we did, and you got to remember, folks, when somebody loses a lot of money, you're not going to put a lot of that into the stock market, even though the market had been going up. What we did, Jan had $300,000 in her 401(b) plan. Bill had about $650,000 in his IRA rollover. What we did is we took $230,000 out of the 300 401(b) plan, and we got an immediate annuity that was based on Jan's life only. And the reason we did that is longevity, age difference, and health issues between Jan and Bill. Jan's family lived into their late 80s and 90s. That would provide $2,000 a month income, which would make up for the shortfall of Jan's, let's say, the difference between her salary and her pension. That would replace the loss. The other issue we had to deal with Bill was he lost a lot of money during the downturn in the stock market, and he wasn't about to go completely into stocks. What we did is we took about $500,000 out of his IRA. We put it into a laddered bond portfolio at 4%. That produced about $20,000 worth of income, and then we put about $230,000 in dividend stocks at 3%. So what we now had was $71,500, which came from Bill's Social Security, Jan's pension. We had $24,000 guaranteed income coming in from the annuity, so that took that income up to close to $96,000. We had $20,000 of secure income coming from Bill's bond portfolio and about $7,000 in dividends. So now we went to a little over $122,000 of income, which created a surplus of over $12,000. One other issue I want to bring up that we brought up here that was key, they owned a nice smaller home on a golf course, which was another hobby of theirs. And one of the issues that Jan had brought up, they had about a $450,000 was the value of their home. They had about a $300,000 mortgage. They wanted to stay in the area, and Jan basically said, I want to stay in this house. I don't want to move to anyplace else. Our friends are here. We're right here on the golf course. So what we did is proposed refinancing it with a 15-year mortgage at 3%. So in 15 years, when Jan is in her early 70s, she would live in a free and clear home. And we now also had a surplus of over $12,000 a year, which could be reinvested on the personal side, which I recommended, dividend paying stocks and adding to that. But that's, John, basically how we solved this issue was we created a secure source of income. We already had it coming from Social Security. We had it coming from Jan's pension. And to meet that secure budget, we created the annuity, immediate annuity from Jan's 403B, which created that extra $24,000 a year, which more than offset and took care of the basic living expenses. So that was it in a nutshell. By taking a look at different sources of income and breaking up their budget and making sure we had a secure source of income.
Let's see how all of this works according to the mind of Professor Wade Fow, who is a noted specialist in the area of retirement. We'll be discussing the 4% solution, how relevant it is today, and some of the new math in the new environment as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Puflava or his lifetime income specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
The government estimates that nearly 11,000 boomers will be heading into retirement on a daily basis over the next decade. But what kind of retirement? Interest rates today are no longer what they were over a decade ago. And on top of that, people are living longer. In inflation rates, it's proven impact older citizens even more. Joining us on the program is Professor Wade Fow from American College of Financial Services in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. Professor, let's talk about this 4% rule, which has been sort of a standard or at least a starting place that's used in financial planning. And it's based on, you know, average life expectancy of about 25 years. If you take out 4% of your principal, well, it'll last 25 years. What's wrong with this assumption in this rule?
Right, that's a very good question. And your lead-in to the discussion really points out the issue. The fact that interest rates are so low today is a really important point. The 4% rule concept is based on looking at U.S. historical data and simulating for a hypothetical individual retiring each year in history, what percent of their assets could they withdraw that gives them some amount that they could sustain over their retirement. And it's based on the worst case scenario from U.S. history. But recently we've seen the 10-year Treasury rate has been below 2%. I think now it's a little bit above 2% again, but it's at historically low levels. And when we look back and say, well, the 4% rule is based on a worst-case scenario, well, 1941 is about the only year in the historical record up until the last few years. It's the only other time we've seen interest rates so low. And yes, the 4% rule did work in that one case, but that's like flipping a coin one time and getting a heads and saying you're always going to get heads. We're really in uncharted waters, and we don't have a good amount of experience of knowing what happens when you're trying to sustain a spending rate that's so far higher than what the bond yield curve can otherwise be supporting for you.
You know, this is rather interesting because we did a calculation, for example, if you go back to the year 2000, Professor, and let's say you wanted $3,000 a month income, you wanted something fairly safe, something like a two-year Treasury note, $540,000 would have got you $3,000 a month income. You take a look at where two-year Treasury notes are today at less than 0.6%, it would take literally millions and millions of dollars to get the same level of income.
Right. I've done similar sorts of calculations on my webpage. I have something now called the retirement dashboard, where I just consider an individual who saves 15% of their salary for 30 years, gets to retirement, and then just looking about what level of safe income could they sustain using basically bonds and what kind of interest rates would support at that time. And for that hypothetical person retiring in 2000, they could have sustained a replacement rate of more than 100% of their pre-retirement salary. But for somebody retiring today, we're looking at replacement rates of 35 to 40% based on what is really, you know, a very aggressive type savings strategy, 15% savings rates over a 30-year period. So that's just reflecting people retiring today who've been consistently saving should be in the mid-range in terms of their wealth accumulation numbers relative to other cohorts from history. But then mid-range wealth combined with extremely low interest rates is leading to really uncomfortably low types of replacement rates from savings right now.
You know, something that we also see, too, is there's a lot of conventional wisdom, not just the 4% rule. One of them has been like, let's say you're age 65, you're age 60. That's the percentage you should have in safe fixed assets like a bond portfolio. 60 years old, 60% in bonds, 40% in stocks. What we've seen, however, is that some of those costs, and especially there was an article on the inflationary effects on seniors, that it is actually higher than the overall economy, and the culprit is healthcare. So just when your expenses really start to escalate later on in your life, there's been a new thought process that you should be increasing your allocation to stocks. Let's talk about that, because that defies conventional wisdom.
Yeah, and about that inflation point, even the Bureau of Labor Statistics, as part of the government, has produced their experimental consumer price index for the elderly that shows the point you are making that when you look at the different spending behaviors of older Americans, the inflation rate does tend to be higher for them. And so then for this issue about the lifetime asset allocation, in the past, most of the focus has been on the pre-retirement period. And I think that makes sense, the idea of the target date funds, where when someone's younger, they can have a more aggressive stock allocation, decrease that stock allocation as they approach their retirement date. That comes from the human capital theory, the idea that younger people, most of their wealth is stored in the form of their future earnings, and earnings tend to behave more like bonds than like stocks. So it can make sense for their more limited investment portfolio to have a higher stock allocation. But there hasn't been a lot of attention about what to do post-retirement. There's been some discussion of to versus through, but it's basically at post-retirement target date funds either level off into a fixed, relatively low stock allocation, or they continue to decrease the stock allocation. And research I did with Michael Kitsis suggested really having a U-shaped lifetime stock allocation as a risk management strategy, that you have the lowest lifetime stock allocation near your retirement date to help with some of the risks related to the market, how market risk intensifies for people once they start taking distributions from their portfolios. But then as retirement goes along, to actually increase gradually the stock allocation. And that can serve as a risk management strategy that can get similar or even slightly better outcomes for retirees relative to what most of the research literature about the 4% rule and the related literature about investing for retirement, which usually tells people to have between 50 and 75% stocks throughout their retirement.
Well, let's talk also about some other things that impact retirement, because another thing that we see very often is individuals take their Social Security much earlier than, let's say, waiting to full retirement age at 66 and 67, not realizing it's one of the few things that is sort of guaranteed in the marketplace right now. And also, we know that, for example, if you wait or make some alterations in how you choose that Social Security benefit for you or your spouse, you can get an 8% increase by waiting. And there's very few things out there that I know, Professor, that goes up 8% a year guaranteed.
Right. The decision to delay Social Security is a really important one to consider. And I think still half of Americans just start Social Security as soon as they can at 62. Social Security provides inflation protection, longevity protection, and protection against market volatility. And in a way that's much more attractive than any commercial insurance company is able to provide with income annuities. And it's an even more important decision now because interest rates are so low. The benefits you get from delaying that 8% increase in benefits that you mentioned, well, it depends how long someone lives for what's really the implied return from that. But the actuaries at the Social Security Administration assume a compounded inflation-adjusted return of 2.9%. in their calculations. So you would add inflation on top of that. And a 2.9% real return is extremely high relative to today's low interest rates, where we have, I think, the 30-year TIPS rate is around 0.6% right now. So it's very hard to beat the implied return from Social Security by trying to invest on one's own. And it's really important to think very carefully about when's the best time to claim Social Security in terms of getting the best lifetime benefits from that. And for someone who ends up living a little bit beyond their life expectancy, they could potentially be looking at more than $100,000 of additional lifetime income by delaying Social Security rather than claiming it early.
You know, this is surprising because they've done a number of studies of those taking it early, and the thought process is, well, if I take it earlier, obviously I'm getting the benefit over more years, but they don't realize the substantial increase by waiting could actually, in most cases, end up producing more income. I want to talk about another problem that retirees are facing today, and that is, you know, we've had two bear markets in the last decade, and drawing down principal when you're going through a bear market could be very dangerous. And especially if you're using, you know, concepts like the 4% rule. I mean, you take a look at what happened to the stock market between 2007 and 2009, when the market's down 45% and you're withdrawing money, that can be quite devastating to your long-term plan.
Market risk gets amplified post-retirement, because pre-retirement, you can think about dollar cost averaging, where somebody who's putting new savings into their portfolio in some sense can benefit from a market decline, because then they get to buy more shares at that point. But that reverses in retirement. If you're trying to sustain a given spending amount from your investments and the market declines, you have to sell an increasing percentage of the remaining shares, or just you have to sell more shares. It's an increasing percentage of the portfolio to fund that spending amount, such that even if and when the market recovers, the portfolio is not going to experience the full recovery. And that's called sequence of returns risk. And that's why even in U.S. history, the 4% rule, the sustainable spending rate is less than you would think based on the average portfolio return over the next 25 or 30 years. It's because it's not just the average returns over long periods of time that matter. It's the specific sequence that those returns come. And for retirees, if you get poor market returns early on, well, that can create a lot of problems. That's the whole issue about why the 4% rule is lower than you would expect, and why with interest rates so low today, we might even really have to adjust the 4% rule further.
Now, you've done some experiments with the 4% rule. You've taken a look at different numbers, a 3% rule. Let's talk about some of the other alternatives that are more durable in terms of long-term outcomes.
Right. And so the 4% rule, I really think of it as a research simplification that the retiree is always taking constant inflation-adjusted spending never adjusting their spending to the market performance or to their portfolio performance. As soon as you create or introduce the willingness to reduce your spending after a market decline, that lets you increase your initial spending rate. And it even does so in a way, it helps to mitigate some of that sequence risk because you're not locking in as many of those losses because you're cutting your spending so that you're not withdrawing as much from your portfolio after it declines. And then there's been a whole host of different strategies that are discussed about how could you spend differently rather than always just spending the same constant inflation-adjusted amount. For instance, you could spend 1% of the remaining portfolio balance each year. You could let your spending be guided by the IRS required minimum distribution rules, which are meant for tax purposes about how much you have to take out of a tax-deferred account, but nonetheless could just be applied as this is how much I'm going to spend as a percent of my portfolio each year. There's other types of rules as well, like Jonathan Guyton and William Klinger developed a series of decision rules about how to make modifications to spending. William Bengen, the individual who created the 4% rule initially, has talked about some different alternatives, such as his floor and ceiling approach, where you do let your spending fluctuate within a range, but you have a dollar amount ceiling and a dollar amount floor that you don't let your spending go outside of that range. And all these types of approaches do help to mitigate some of the sequence of returns risk, which creates some synergies that you can spend more initially and not necessarily then ever see your spending fall by as much as you would have always been if you were really stuck to a very rigid, I'm always going to spend the same constant inflation adjusted amount no matter what my portfolio is doing type of strategy implied by the 4% rule.
Let's talk about another risk that has hit a lot of retirees today, and that has been this precipitous drop that we've seen in interest rates since the financial panic and, let's say, the downturn of 2007 and 2009. This drop in interest rates, a lot of retirees went into bond funds, let's say at the beginning of the decade, interest rates were 5 or 6%. And what they saw over the ensuing decade is interest rates, the dividend distributions fell each year. Let's talk about using bonds in a portfolio. And, you know, when you buy an individual bond, you get something that's predictable. You know what the maturity date is. You know what the interest rate is. It never changes. But most investors, Professor, use bond funds where you have no maturity. You don't know what the income is going to be. Let's talk about the use of bonds, bond funds, and then an alternative, which you've done studies on, which is an immediate annuity, and talk about the differences between them and the advantages or disadvantages of each one.
Okay, sure. So my research increasingly points to not using bond funds in retirement income plans, that bond funds, they're volatile assets. If interest rates go up, you can have capital losses on your bond fund, and that's important to remember. But they're still really meant to be less volatile than stocks, and so they act as a volatility reduction tool as part of the overall portfolio. But for retirees, I think the focus is much more on sustaining income over life rather than just simply looking at what are the maximum risk-adjusted returns I can get on my portfolio. And that's where, as you mentioned, if you hold individual bonds to their maturity dates, then at the maturity date, you're going to get the face value. Now, if you bought a bond and then interest rates go up, you'd have a paper loss. If you looked at what you'd be able to sell that bond for, it would be less. But that paper loss will gradually disappear as the maturity date approaches, and you get the amount of income you're expecting at the maturity date. And if that's the amount of income you wanted to be able to spend, then that works for you. And then an income annuity is like a bond ladder of individual bonds, but with a maturity date that's not set in advance. The amount of time that you'll receive those bond payments is how long the individual actually lives. So if somebody has a short retirement, they would not get as many payments from that, but then at that point, they don't need as many payments. And if they have a long retirement, well, then the income annuity is going to work much better for them than trying to just hold a bond fund, because they're also getting, well, it's this idea of mortality credits with the income annuity, that the income annuity is pooling longevity risk across a large number of people. So it's able to pay out based on each person living somewhere close to their life expectancy. And then those who do not live very long end up subsidizing the income to those who live longer. And to the extent that nobody knows which of those categories they're going to fall into in advance, that can be an attractive proposition of being able to spend more consistently throughout retirement, rather than if you're just trying to simply manage your retirement with a quote-unquote self-annuitization strategy. It usually means you have to be more conservative. You have to assume you're going to live 30 or 40 years, potentially, even if your life expectancy is only 20 years. And that means spending less throughout your retirement and being extra conservative. And in the end, by being conservative, you might leave a very large legacy behind. But you certainly were in a position where you could have been able to spend a lot more. And that's what an income annuity can do, allow for someone to feel more comfortable spending more because of this pooling of the longevity risk.
You know, you bring up something about immediate annuities that offer boomers today something their parents once had, and that was a defined benefit pension plan. I tend to look at immediate annuities like a defined benefit pension plan, which indeed is what they were. You know, those plans that gave retirees a set amount of income in a pension when they retired, it was basically the company taking a pot of money, giving it to an insurance company based on their age, and they got back an income figure. Let's talk about why that's important, because when a person retires, at least when we do planning, we try to take a look at two aspects of their budget, their basic expenses. What does it cost to live on a daily basis, whether it's rent, whether it's retirement home payments, whatever it is, food, cost, utilities. And then I call it the sort of the bucket list, the things they like to do, travel, play golf. That's another list. Talk about how it is really important for somebody, as you just mentioned, about not worrying about outliving their assets, of having predictable forms of income that don't run out, like an immediate annuity and Social Security.
Right. So the defined benefit pension did two really important things to help individuals. It helped to share or to pool market risk, and it pooled longevity risk. The different individuals going through the company getting the defined benefit pension, well, their pensions were based on some formula about the number of years they worked and then how much they get for each year they work. And so whatever the formula is, it was a defined benefit that was not subject to the specific market returns that individual would experience. And so some individuals, had they saved all that on their own, all their contributions into the pension, had that all gone into their own defined contribution account instead, some would have had more than the defined benefit could support, but some would have less. And that risk gets pooled across the large cohort of workers. And then the defined benefit pension could pool that longevity risk as well, for the same reason as I was discussing about with the income annuity, because it's essentially the same sort of thing. All those workers, we don't know how long any individual retiree is going to live, but with a large group of them, we have a pretty good idea about what the distribution is and what the life expectancy is. And so people can be paid according to that. And those benefits of the defined benefit pension are lost in our defined contribution world. People are forced to take on the market risk and the longevity risk on their own. So then, as you were saying about making a distinction between essential spending needs, things that are more fixed and need to be spent versus discretionary, well, it can make a lot of sense to really try to lock in those essentials in some way, that not having the essentials be too exposed to stock market volatility, to just really have some other contractual guarantee of some sort, whether it's individual bonds, which don't have the longevity protection, or income annuities, which do also have the longevity protection, something that's going to give the income expected at the date it's expected. There's really two schools of thought about retirement income planning, and I call them probability-based and safety-first. And for some people, just the psychological comfort of this safety-first, of having the essentials covered with some sort of contractual guarantee, can really then make a big difference for how they view their retirement and how they can sleep at night and so forth.
Professor, you've done a number of combinations, taking a look at different approaches, different withdrawal rates, combinations of different assets. One that has worked out more favorable, at least reading your work, has been, for example, the combination of an immediate annuity, so you can never outlive that asset portion or income portion of the annuity payments along with Social Security, combining that with stocks. Let's talk about that. And how does this solve problems that we talk about, living longer, outliving your assets, and inflation, which many retirees are facing today.
Right. And so maybe it's important to just mention, too, that delaying Social Security is like buying an income annuity, and it's a better deal than any commercial annuity providers can make. So as the first step of thinking about buying an annuity, wouldn't it make a lot of sense to claim Social Security at 62 and use those benefits to buy an annuity? The step one, delay Social Security, and then if you still want more income, then look at buying the income annuity. But right, what you're mentioning was really the punchline of a research article I wrote about trying to build efficient retirement income strategies. What I found was instead of holding stock funds and bond funds, retirees were really better off holding stock funds and income annuities, that the income annuities replace bonds in the retirement income portfolio. And it's really just because they're better matched to the spending needs of the individual. That for individuals with shorter retirements, they don't need as much to spend because it's not an all or nothing decision if they put part of their assets into an income annuity. They'll have a smaller legacy than otherwise should their retirement not last very long. But their heirs are still going to get a pretty big amount just because at that point their retirement didn't last very long. They didn't spend as much of their assets. On the other hand, for individuals who live a very long time into retirement, that's going to provide a lot of relief for the portfolio so that the partial annuitization strategy can ultimately allow for a larger legacy to be left behind than investments only should someone live a long time. Because later in retirement, so much of that income is being generated from that mortality credit, the subsidies from those in the risk pool who didn't live very long, that it really can allow a bigger legacy for people longer into retirement. And so you can sustain the same income and really have this chance to provide a more meaningful legacy, because for someone who lives a very long time, they've spent more of their assets. The legacy might be smaller no matter what they do. But at that point, each dollar counts a lot more, and that's where the partial annuitization strategy can really pay off and create possibilities for the same or more income with the same or more legacy, both criteria. Usually there's the trade-off between those criteria, but you really can get more income and more legacy than with stocks and income annuities than with stocks and traditional bonds. And that's something I see again and again as I approach this type of research question from different angles.
Well, certainly, I think investors have no idea what the kind of risks that they could face in bond funds, given the low interest rate markets that we've faced today, which are at century lows. I mean, a good example is what happened to 10-year German bond yields that were 7 basis points and went to 72 basis points in just 2 weeks. Professor, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about your pioneering work on retirement, how can they do so, please?
Thanks. Yes, I do have a website. It's all one word, retirementresearcher.com. And that's where I keep my blog and some other resources. So thank you very much. That's the best way to find me on the internet.
Well, Professor, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. And once again, congratulations by being picked as one of the most influential individuals in the area of finance and your pioneering work regarding retirement. All the best to you, sir. Come back and talk to us again.
Thanks. And it was a pleasure talking to you.
You know, Jim, it's interesting what the professor had to say here, because what he was emphasizing was the risk of bond funds. And we've been listening on the weekend program when you and I talk on this whole thing about how the stock market's doing well, dividend paying stocks are doing well. But in bonds, there are certain risks. I mean, you really take a risk. Say, for example, look at what happened in the taper tantrum. Was it, what, 2013, something like that? And this is pretty much just confirming what we're saying. But you can smell change in the wind, can't you?
Yeah. In fact, I'm getting ready to write an article, probably the first one I've written in probably 3 or 4 years, about a warning about an approaching storm. And that storm is going to be in the bond market. And a good example, as I mentioned in that interview with the professor, is what we saw happen to the European bond market. Just in 2 weeks, we erased nearly 3.5 months of rally in the bond market. And people have no idea, John, that they can lose money in bond funds. They're not predictable. They're not providing a lot of the safety net a lot of people thought they were going to have when they went into retirement. So we're going to be doing a show on that next weekend. Hope you'll be there to join us for that. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.